Spanish-themed mini golf course has recently opened to public in New York City. It consists of 18 holes, each one featuring an environmental problem or a potential solution like habitat loss, energy efficiency, and emissions. Designed by local artists, the course is made with recycled materials.
Climate change and the environment are such important topics right now, and important issues that faces all of us now and will face us in future generations. So by bringing the environmental issues to the forefront in a fun, playful way like mini golf, it really sparks the conversation and helps folks understand the scope of the issue.
Visitors have welcomed the idea, saying it's both entertaining and educational. Organizers say all of the money made from the golf course will go to two local environmental groups. Let's go to Ukraine to meet the world's oldest tennis player, who has been playing the sport for over half a century. Leonid Stanislavski, now 97 years old, has competed in various world championships. When he was a 30-year-old gymnast, he started training tennis three times a week. The Guinness World Record holder is now practicing for the 2021 Super Seniors World Championship, which will be held in Mallorca, Spain. Stanislavski believes that people can play tennis at any age.
It's an elegant type of sport. It's good physical exercise. It is a beautiful game, and there is one more thing about tennis. You can play tennis no matter what age you are.
The world's oldest tennis player revealed his secret to a long life, a combination of good genes and regular sport. His goal is to live to 100 years old and take on prominent tennis player Roger Federer. The old athlete also wishes to make a parachute jump. The largest museum in the world dedicated to the study of space has made its debut in Shanghai, China. Inspired by the orbits of celestial bodies, the layout of the building has no straight lines or right angles. The museum, designed by New York-based Anid Architects, is intended to create an immersive experience for visitors to engage in a real astronomical phenomenon. For instance, visitors can take a trip into a starry night in the optical planetarium theater.
What we aim to create is a real environment for people to look up to the starry sky. To achieve this goal, we've installed a high-precision planetarium projector at the center of the theater, which can project the sharp spots of stars on the screen with countless optical fibers. The demonstration effects are very vivid.
After moving through the museum's galleries and curved hallways, the final area visitors pass through is the sky space of the Inverted Dome. The viewing area of the Inverted Dome is about reducing almost all separation between people and the stars. The opening follows a five-year construction process in the city's Lingang district.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
UK Parliament's Public Accounts Committee warned earlier this year that the government was not doing enough to prevent damage from flooding, and said councils and local authorities needed much more help, including more cash. We have prepared for you an article written by environment correspondent Fiona Harvey under the heading, Scientists Say Flash Floods Will Be More Common as Climate Crisis Worsens. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Scientists have warned flash flooding of the type seen in London recently will become a more common occurrence as the climate crisis worsens. And the British government, businesses and householders must do much more to protect against future harm. Dr. Jess Neumann, a hydrologist at the University of Reading, said, "Flooding from intense summer rainfall is going to happen more frequently. No city, town or village is immune to flooding, and we all need to take hard action right now if we are to prevent impacts from getting worse in the future." Climate policy in the United Kingdom has focused on cutting greenhouse gas emissions, which is a primary concern, to reduce the human impact on the climate and ensure global heating does not reach catastrophic levels. But the government has also been warned frequently that measures to cope with the impacts of extreme weather are urgently needed, and that the United Kingdom has been falling behind on such adaptive measures. Adapting to the impacts will require a thorough overhaul of the UK's infrastructure, encompassing not only drainage and water supply systems and transport, to ensure they're not overwhelmed, as many in London were at the recent flash flooding, but also energy supply and communication networks. Buildings will need to be redesigned and public areas revamped to include better drainage channels and storm drains, while more innovative approaches could include porous pavements. Experts warned a lack of green space and vegetation and the paving over of many areas without heat to flood risk has compounded the problem in many cities, including London, and also this needs to be addressed. Dr. Jess Neumann, a hydrologist from the University of Reading, said, "Planning and development needs to consider flood risk and all sources, river, groundwater and flash floods, and adapt accordingly. It is not acceptable to keep paving over the land and expect the public to deal with the water when it comes into their homes. One of the problems is that responsibility for flood protection in the United Kingdom is split among many authorities, with little central oversight." Liz Stevens, Associate Professor of Climate Resilience at Reading University, said, "The United Kingdom still has a complicated set of roles and responsibilities for surface water flooding risk. Lead local flood authorities take responsibility for managing it, the Environment Agency for mapping it, and the Met Office for providing early warning. This makes it difficult for the public to have a good understanding of their own risk and what can be done." She said there was a lack of even basic data caused by a refusal to invest in more precise research. She said, "The surface water flood hazard maps for the UK have not been improved since 2013. These urgently need updating. The current accuracy of surface water flood maps reflect an investment choice and not what is possible with the state-of-the-art science." She added, "It is difficult to help people prepare for surface water flooding if they don't know they are at risk, and if they don't receive precise warnings of the likely impacts when heavy rain is forecast." The British Parliament's Public Accounts Committee warned earlier this year that the government was not doing enough to prevent damage from flooding, and said councils and local authorities needed much more help, including more cash. Meg Hillier, the chair of the committee and a London MP, told The Guardian, "The recent floods highlighted the government's inaction." She said, "This latest flooding underlines the committee's concerns about the resources available for floods, which are becoming more frequent." She added, "Flash flooding from torrential rain causes havoc for those affected, and yet the lack of resources for councils, which are responsible for the mitigation of urban flooding, is hampering the response which businesses and householders so desperately need." Darren Rodwell, environment spokesperson at the Local Government Association, which represents local councils, echoed Meg Hillier's call. Darren Rodwell said, "Councils are best placed to ensure that flood defence money is directed towards projects that best reflect local needs, including protecting key roads and bridges to keep local residents and businesses moving. Funding for flood defences needs to be devolved to local areas and sit within a new national framework for addressing the climate emergency." Sadiq Khan, the Mayor of London, said his powers were limited on flood defences, but he was dealing urgently with Thames Water on this issue. He said, "We are seeing increasing incidents of extreme weather events linked to climate change." Sadiq Khan added, "This is not the first time in recent weeks that London has been hit by major flooding. Despite having limited powers in the area, it remains a key priority for myself and London Council leaders that more is done urgently to tackle flooding and the other impact of climate change. This includes continuing to urge Thames Water, the UK's largest water and wastewater services company, to address localised issues with infrastructure that may exacerbate the impact of flooding." Insurers are among those most concerned about the impact of climate breakdown and have warned the British households and businesses in some areas could find themselves uninsurable if stronger action is not taken. Adam Winslow, the chief executive of Aviva General Insurance, said, "It's too late to stop the effects of climate change from happening, but we can reduce the impact it will have on our lives. Action is needed now to improve regulation about where and how properties are built, encourage the use of resilient materials, and consider innovative and natural solutions to climate change."
A recent report by the Council on American-Islamic Relations shows anti-Muslim hate crimes have been on the rise in the United States this year. In a mid-year report, America's largest Muslim civil rights and advocacy organization detailed several instances of incidents, including hate crimes, harassment, school bullying, discrimination, and hate speech. The Council documented a spike in anti-Muslim incidents in May and June, including four at mosques in May alone. These cases include vandalism, harassment towards women who wear hijab or headscarf, and an attempt at stabbing. The spike coincided with Israel's 11-day war on the Gaza Strip that ended in a May 21st ceasefire and killed at least 250 Palestinians.
Well, there are a number of reasons. One, I think Donald Trump brought white nationalism and discrimination and even racism against Muslims, Arabs, and Palestinians into mainstream American political discourse. The other reason is, of course, that Israel launched an attack on Gaza in May of 2021. For 11 days, they bombed Gaza, and the militant groups in Gaza retaliated by firing rockets back into Israel.
The growing number of anti-Muslim hate incidents is drawing reactions from the U.S. Congress, too. Minnesota's Democratic Representative Ilhan Omar is leading a group of lawmakers calling on the U.S. President Joe Biden to nominate a special envoy to combat Islamophobia. The group has pointed to a rising number of individuals connected to larger white supremacist networks as perpetrators of Islamophobia. In a letter to U.S. State Secretary Antony Blinken, Congresswoman Ilhan Omar also referred to a June 6 car attack in Canada that killed four members of the same Muslim family.
Their lives were taken in a brutal, cowardly, and brazen act of violence. This killing was no accident. This was a terrorist attack motivated by hatred in the heart of one of our communities.
The National Council of Canadian Muslims urged Trudeau to address what it called the deep-seated systemic Islamophobia in the country, suggesting the appointment of a special envoy to confront the issue. Back in March, United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres cited a UN report which found that suspicion, discrimination, and outright hatred towards Muslims has risen to, quote, epidemic proportions.
Anti-Muslim bigotry is sadly in line with other distressing trends we are seeing globally. A resurgence in ethno-nationalism, neo-Nazism, stigma and hate speech targeting vulnerable populations, including Muslims, Jews, some minority Christian communities, as well as others.
But this is a relatively new phenomenon. The anti-Palestinian, anti-Arab, anti-Muslim view has had, you know, over 100 years of being part of the American psyche, and the pro-Israel forces, both the evangelical Christians and, of course, the Zionist Jews, have been very, very successful in getting their narrative accepted without question.
Limitations on Muslims sharing their beliefs, discrimination on receiving citizenship, and defaming Muslim communities were some manifestations of anti-Muslim biases the UN chief mentioned. Guterres added that Muslim women face triple levels of discrimination because of their gender, ethnicity, and faith, while the media and some persons in power have further compounded the stereotypes. The UN has called for the adoption of a global strategy that includes defeating all forms of violent ideologies. The question is how to execute such a strategy to make it appealing to all nations and people.
Tens of thousands of people in France, the UK, Italy, and Greece protested against coronavirus restrictions and mandatory vaccination policies, sparking clashes with police forces. The European governments tried to force more unvaccinated people to receive their coronavirus shots by using sanctions. In France, nearly 160,000 people held nationwide protests against the implementation of a health pass by President Emmanuel Macron's government. Demonstrators slammed this policy by saying it's an attack on their liberty. Macron's health pass will ban access to restaurants and public spaces for unvaccinated people. During the rallies, tensions flared up as French anti-riot police fired tear gas toward protesters and used water cannons to disperse them. Several demonstrators have also been arrested. Elsewhere in Europe, thousands of Italians took to the streets of Rome, Naples, and Turin against the government's introduction of restrictions on unvaccinated people. Protesters chanted slogans such as "Freedom" and "Down with the dictatorship" over plans for a government certificate known as the Green Pass. The Green Pass is an extension of the EU's digital COVID certificate and will be required from August 6th to enter cinemas, museums, indoor swimming pools, or sports stadiums, or eat indoors at restaurants. Thousands of people have also protested in London against what they describe as an erosion of their civil liberties. Demonstrators denounced the UK government's track and trace app, saying it limits their movements over 600,000 people are told to self-isolate in 1 week alone this month. The protests come a week after most coronavirus restrictions in England were lifted. Police used tear gas and water cannon to disperse more than 4,000 people who had gathered in central Athens to protest against mandatory COVID-19 vaccinations. Police sources claim that some protesters had thrown petrol bombs, prompting the police to respond with tear gas.
Certainly the lockdowns are making people unhappy. They're driving up unemployment. They're adding to general restlessness. But the problem is broader. I mean, I think people are upset about the poor economy, which is and slow economic growth, which is now in its 13th or 14th year.
Tens of thousands of Brazilians took to the streets and called for the impeachment of President Bolsonaro, who is facing increasing pressure as the pandemic exacts a devastating toll. The South American nation has been grappling with the world's second deadliest outbreak after the United States, with over 500,000 deaths. Demonstrators and police scuffled in Sao Paulo, with the smoke rising from tear gas canisters and flashbangs exploding. Bolsonaro has seen his popularity declining amid a Senate probe into corruption scandals tied to the purchase of COVID-19 vaccines. His approval rating is at a low record of 24%. Bolsonaro has been famously dismissive of the health crisis, the need to wear face masks, and lockdown measures to halt the spread of the virus. In Australia, protesters carried signs and banners reading, "Wake up Australia," and "Drain the Swamp." Demonstrators defied a month-long stay-at-home order by participating in the unauthorized march in Sydney. Nearly 60 attendees were arrested. Demonstrators clashed with police officers and threw projectiles at them. Authorities suggested that the COVID-related restrictions could remain in place until October.
People have lost faith in the political classes. They don't believe that the politicians in charge know what they're doing. They are quite angry and upset.
In many countries, anti-lockdown anger has merged with other grievances. Demonstrators criticize governments for suspending their right to protest because of the public health crisis. In addition, economic hardship and anxiety have further fueled public anger. According to a multi-agency United Nations report published last week, world hunger and malnutrition levels worsened dramatically last year, with most of the increase likely due to the coronavirus pandemic. The report said nearly 768 million people across the globe were undernourished in 2020, as the COVID-19 pandemic disrupted economies, job markets, and supply chains, as well as inflated food prices. The increase last year was equal to that of the previous 5 years combined. According to the report published by UN agencies including the Food and Agriculture Organization, the World Food Program, and the World Health Organization, Asia accounts for over half of all undernourished people globally, while Africa experienced the biggest spike. The report says more than 149 million children under 5 are estimated to be afflicted with stunted growth. That means their brains and bodies do not grow to their full potential. Also, children who suffer from chronic hunger are more likely to die before reaching maturity. However, food insecurity was already spreading across the globe before the pandemic due to the conflicts, economic recessions, and climate change. That's why nearly all low- and mid-income countries have experienced economic downturns in 2020. Low-income countries are more vulnerable to food price shocks in particular. While a surge in consumer food price inflation predates the pandemic, early lockdown measures and supply chain disruptions induced a spike in the prices. Also, higher transport costs increased consumer food inflation. Some experts believe that food scarcity will probably trigger social unrest and bring people out into the streets, which is likely to make the next few months unstable.
Well, I think that we have to understand that the food problem is not simply a result of the COVID problem, but it's also a profound problem as a result of climate change.
...2020 posed a serious blow to food security around the world, and the effects of the pandemic are expected to linger. In 2030, an estimated 30 million more people may face hunger than would have without the COVID-19 outbreak. Many factors affect food security around the world. Therefore, a food system approach is required to find effective solutions. A report by the State of Food Security and Nutrition in the World has recommended a number of actions to help prevent undernourishment. Those include increasing resiliency to conflict, climate change, and economic shocks, and sustainably ensuring access to affordable, nutritious food.
What we have to understand, and what we should, as a society, be doing is encouraging increasing local trading systems and farmer-supported, community-supported farming organizations, such as those that exist around the world. It's called community-supporting agriculture, and they're very, very important because they provide a counterbalance to the increasing control and the lack of diversity that the large corporations are offering.
Food insecurity has been on the rise since the mid-2010s, especially in countries affected by conflict, climate extremes, economic downturns, or battling high inequality. The pandemic only exacerbated these existing challenges with significant negative effects, particularly for poor nations. Therefore, things are not going to change for better unless nations across the globe start working together.
On Friday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with visiting Iraqi Foreign Minister Fuad Hussein at the State Department. The meeting comes ahead of discussions on the role of U.S. military forces in Iraq. U.S. media have cited American officials as saying that the two countries are expected to formalize the end of Washington's combat mission in Iraq by the end of the year. That shift is reportedly planned to be announced on Monday when U.S. President Joe Biden hosts Iraqi Prime Minister at the White House. It could potentially mark a new chapter in the ties between the U.S. and Iraq, 18 years after Washington deployed its troops in the West Asian country. In an interview, the Iraqi foreign minister said the presence of American combat units in Iraq is unnecessary at this stage. He said what Iraq needs is cooperation in intelligence and training, as well as Air Force support. Earlier this week, Iraqi Prime Minister also stressed that American combat troops should leave his country.
I believe that the U.S. will not fully disengage from Iraq. My guess is they will leave some troops there in at least an advisory capacity, and also that they will augment the official military with private contractors. I don't expect the U.S. to totally leave Iraq.
In the meantime, resistance movements in Iraq say the presence of the U.S. forces in the Arab country will only benefit Israel. Anti-U.S. sentiments in Iraq have been running high since January 2020, when Washington assassinated Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani, along with the deputy commander of the PMU forces, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, in an airstrike near Baghdad airport. Following the assassination, the Iraqi parliament adopted a resolution that called on the government to end the presence of all foreign troops in the country. Iraqi resistance groups have pledged to take up arms against U.S. forces if Washington fails to comply with the parliamentary order. While the U.S. justifies its presence in Iraq with fight against Daesh, Iraqis are stressing that they don't need foreign troops and that they're capable of dealing with the issue themselves.
The U.S., at least at times, has assisted groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda, and I expect the U.S. to continue to do that. The reason the U.S. will stay in Iraq is to be able to have a base of operations from which to attack Iran and Syria and other countries and entities in the Middle East that the U.S. deems to be enemies.
On the other hand, the fact that apart from Daesh terrorists, the U.S. is the only perpetrator of attacks on Iraq's anti-terror popular mobilization units, which are legally incorporated as part of the Iraqi military, puts the U.S. claim of fighting terrorists in perspective.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In Britain, stop and search powers for police officers are said to be permanently enhanced under Boris Johnson's new strategy to tackle crime. The Prime Minister will use his first day after leaving self-isolation following a positive coronavirus contact to detail his new beating crime plan, much of which was trailed in the media over the weekend. The article you're about to hear has been written by the London Evening Standard journalist Sean Morrison. The piece is titled, Police Stop and Search Powers to be Boosted Under Crackdown. Stay with us for more of Sean Morrison's article. Britain's stop and search powers for police officers are said to be permanently enhanced under Boris Johnson's new strategy to tackle crime. The Prime Minister will use his first day after leaving self-isolation following a positive coronavirus contact to detail his new beating crime plan, much of which was trailed in the media over the weekend. It will include a permanent relaxing of conditions under use of Section 60 stop and search powers, under which police officers can search someone without reasonable grounds in an area where serious violence is expected. Boris Johnson's announcement comes as the chairman of the Police Federation prepares to deliver a letter to Downing Street, setting out police officers' anger over a pay freeze and objections to how the plan was announced. Labour leader Keir Starmer has also dismissed as a ridiculous gimmick a pledge by Prime Minister Boris Johnson to provide victims of crime with a named police officer to call about their case. Boris Johnson's reforms for England and Wales will also see the extension of a pilot announced earlier this year, which involves burglars and thieves being made to wear GPS tags on release from prison. The strategy will also trial the use of alcohol tags, which detect alcohol in the sweat of the wearer. On prison leavers in Wales, in a bid to reduce alcohol-related crime. The plans will also permanently reverse limits imposed on police stop and search by Boris Johnson's predecessor, Theresa May, during her time as Home Secretary. Section 60 powers give police officers the right to search people in a defined area during a specific time period when they expect serious violence. And police officers can look for weapons before they can be used, or those used in recent attack. The permanent change follows a nationwide pilot which reduced the level of authorization needed to impose a Section 60 order and lowered the degree of certainty required. But on the day that further details of the Prime Minister's crime blitz strategy are revealed, Chairman of the Police Federation, John Apter, will take a letter to No. 10 Downing Street, setting out police officers' anger. The Police Federation of England and Wales, representing more than 130,000 police officers from the rank of constable to chief inspector, passed a motion of no confidence in Home Secretary Priti Patel last week in a row over pay. Police officers who earn more than £24,000 a year are subject to a pay freeze this year, compared with NHS staff, who will receive 3%, and firefighters and local government workers, who will get 1.5%. The strategy will also include plans for leak tables for Forces 101 and 999 call answering times, a national online platform to allow the public to contact police, and efforts against county line drug gangs to be intensified. It also includes a £17 million package to persuade young people who go to an emergency department with a stab wound or have contact with police officers to stay away from violence. But Irina Ponya, policy manager at the Children's Society charity, said intervention should take place long before young people end up in hospital. She added, "Prevention is better than cure. We need to be helping young people well before they end up being rushed into accidents and emergency wards fighting for their lives. We want to see a long-term plan for investment in early help for children at the first signs that they are vulnerable to being groomed. Short-term limited resources do not go far enough in providing the solutions needed across the country. Targeted help for young people and families and universal services like youth clubs have been victims of devastating government funding cuts everywhere over the last decade. Greater investment in early intervention needs to be a key part of a coherent national strategy setting out the government's approach to tackling child criminal exploitation."
Approximately 4 kilometers from the Norwegian border. We want to go 5 kilometers inside Norway to buy fish. Norwegian fish is better than Swedish fish. My name is Ali Reza Bashiri. I was born in Ahvaz. I'm 52 and I live in Sweden with my daughter and grandson. Let's go make fish and see how it tastes. Welcome to the Kingdom of Sweden. Do they have a king or a queen? I think I'm the king. This is my grandchild. I'm Daniel's grandfather. This is my only grandchild. I love him even more than my own daughter. I mean, my grandson comes first, then comes my daughter. Today, my daughter was going to make lunch. But I told her now that the movie is going to be screened in Iran, let the Iranian men know that when they come to Europe, they have to cook like women and they have to learn it.
It took me a while to learn. I don't like cooking very much.
Girls usually learn cooking from their mothers.
Yes, somehow, but I learned it from my father. Back then, I wanted him to come here. I wanted to have, what do you say for connection in Farsi?
She wanted to have somebody to rely on. But when she saw her mother for the first time, she said, I think I've seen her before. When I was a child, I really liked to live somewhere in Scandinavia. When I studied geography at school, I really liked to see a Scandinavian country. It finally happened, and now I'm living here. Back then, I thought it would be so fascinating. But now I think wherever you go in the world, life is the same. When we got married, I told my wife I'd like to go abroad and live in another country. My wife was just 17 and myself around 22 to 23. I didn't have that much experience. We decided to go to Europe from Turkey. If you walk for 1 kilometer, you'll reach the Norwegian border.
Yes, then we'll be in Norway.
We went from Turkey to Germany, and we sought asylum. We spent around 2 years in a refugee camp. The MKO members were very active there. They came into the camp and advertised for their organization. As a young man, and given my perception of the MKO, their propaganda made me think they were going to capture Tehran. Let's join them and not get left behind. They told me to go to Iraq with my wife. At that time, my daughter had just been born. She was only 4 months old. We decided that my wife, daughter, and I should move to Iraq. So we decided to go, but when we flew in Baghdad, I saw the true face of the organization. It was totally different than what I thought it was in Tehran and Germany. They told me I had to move to the men's camp and that my wife and child had to go to the women's camp. After 2 or 3 weeks, I told them I had a wife and kid.
Sorry, I should take Daniel to sleep.
After 2 or 3 weeks, I told them I had a wife and a child. Then they asked me where they were and said they would follow it up. What's her name? I said, Razia Khabbazan. They asked, what's your daughter's name? I said, Nushin Bashiri. They wrote it all down and told me they'd let me know. But after 2 weeks, I heard nothing. Then I asked them what had happened. You know what's wrong with us? You want to raise him the Norwegian way, but I prefer the Iranian style of parenting. Iranian parent says, wait till your child is sleepy, then they will sleep on their own. But according to your method, the child must sleep on time.
My system is much better.
That's why we have differences. When I was doing military service, I was in the Hamza artillery unit. What did you do there? We fired artillery shells at the Iraqis. When I joined the MKO, I fired artillery shells at fellow Iranians. I never understood why we did so much of it. I got familiar with them very briefly. I had previously been exposed to a bit of propaganda in Germany. Considering my confusion in Germany and my sense of adventure, I decided to go to Iraq to see what was going on there. I had no idea I would get stuck there and frustrated too. We had to write a daily report about our mistakes during the day. Even if there was no mistake, we had to write something. We were forced to write about hypothetical things, so they let us go. For instance, I sometimes wrote, last night I dreamt of Ahwaz and my family. Then I realized that saps my energy while I had to devote that energy to sister Maryam Rajavi and brother Masood Rajavi. That's what makes them happy and makes them say, wow. I believe they are a sect. I won't give up on that belief, and I say it out loud wherever I go. At the beginning, I really thought Rajavi himself wasn't aware of it. I thought Masood Rajavi didn't approve of the behavior of the low-ranking officials. But then I realized it was his own idea. For example, we had a general meeting every 2 or 3 months of all the troops from all the bases, including Ashraf and others. We'd gathered in an assembly hall. It was a large venue in Ashraf where Masood and Maryam Rajavi lectured us. Before that, they'd search our bodies thoroughly. Even with the injured members, if the scan showed metal pieces in their legs, they would force them to take off their pants to show that there was nothing else there. During the meetings, nobody dared to ask any questions. Once someone stood up and asked, I have a question, brother. Rajavi said, okay. He said, we are all mujahids, fighters. None of us carries weapons now. They also search our lockers every week, so no one has any bullets. He also searches with special equipment. So what's up with this kind of search? We are a part of the system. Masood turned to Maryam and said, Maryam, tell him why. I always tell you there is no need to search them, but you say we should. Maryam said, you know, in Iran and the entire planet, and she put it this way, since the time of Sattar Khan and Baghar Khan, we haven't had a leader like Masood Rajavi. That's why we should be very careful. He is not responsible for his own security. We are responsible for his security because we know what kind of leader he is, and we should protect him until the revolution takes place. That's why I ordered the search. It is not Masood's order. Masood says, let the members come in freely. They told us the leadership meeting would be held tonight. Masood Rajavi wanted to hold a meeting. He said Iran had accepted the peace deal and the war was going to be over. He asked if everyone was ready for an operation because the MKO had decided to head to Tehran. Everybody said yes. He said, that's great. So go get prepared because we are going to launch the operation in the next 4 days. I think it was the night of July 26, 1988, when the order for the operation was issued. I was the driver of a fuel tanker. When we were heading from Ghasr Shirin to Kerand, we suddenly found ourselves under fire from the surrounding hills, but we took to the road and forged ahead. Then we saw lines of civilian cars coming from Kermanshah to Islamabad. The road was blocked and the MKO tanks couldn't move because the road was swarming with civilians. We asked why they wouldn't move, and they said because there was a battle in Charzavar Strait. We waited until the battle ended. Suddenly, we saw the Iranian warplanes above us. They bombarded the road. They hit the entire convoy. Everybody left the tanks to take shelter. On the second day, we had no water and food. I also hadn't slept for 4 days, so I fell asleep. After 3 to 4 hours, I heard loud explosions. I woke up and rubbed my eyes. I wasn't sure what time it was. Then I saw our tanks in front of the convoy get hit by RPG grenades. There was nobody there. They had left the tanks and escaped. I came down to see what was happening. I forgot the car was carrying 10,000 liters of fuel, and a single bullet could blow it up. I was so dizzy, and I didn't know where to hide. Then I saw them firing RPG grenades at us from the mountaintop. I decided to hide behind a rock. I was trying to get away from the tanker. I found a rock to hide behind, but when I got within 3 to 4 meters of it, an RPG shell blew it up. I told myself, well, that's it, Ali, you're dead. And there was nobody to make a will to. Believe me, at that moment, I suddenly thought of my daughter, Nooshin. When I look back, I still can't tell how I managed to take a 4-month-old baby to Iraq, a country that was at war with Iran. This was while I myself used to fight against Iraq. When I think back about taking a 4-month-old baby, my own child, to the Iraqi deserts, it seems as if it wasn't me. I was really out of my mind at the time. 1 month after the operation, they told us Masoud Rajavi himself was going to hold a meeting at the assembly hall. Out of the 6,000 troops who had participated in the operation, only about 3,000 of us were there. Some of them were even brought in on stretchers. That means nearly half of them were not there anymore. Then Rajavi asked each of the commanders who hadn't got injured about the reason for the defeat. He said, "To stand up. Why did we withdraw? We weren't defeated, were we?" The commander said, "No, we weren't defeated." Rajavi asked, "So why didn't we capture Tehran?" The commander said, "Because we didn't understand Sister Mariam's revolution." Rajavi asked, "What was the problem with the operation?" The commander said, "If we fully and wholeheartedly understood and implemented Sister Mariam's revolution, we would have been killed in the operation, or we wouldn't have returned to Ashraf unhurt, and we wouldn't have assembled here now." Then there were rumors about a second revolution. We would see the commanders leave from 8 p.m. to 5 a.m. We, in the lower ranks, asked ourselves, where do they go? Apparently, they went to Rajavi's meetings with the high-ranking commanders. A month after the meetings, I noticed they weren't wearing their wedding rings anymore. They had taken them off. I had a close friend. We made friends in the very first days. After a year, he asked to leave. He said he didn't want to stay in Ashraf and that he wanted to leave. When he left Ashraf, they transferred him to Pakistan. I became very lonely. I was thinking about her. I wanted to leave so I could save her from the condition she was in. She was a little girl. She was about 2 years old. When I told my supervisor about my intention to leave, I got a harsh treatment. I went to his room and told him I wanted to have a word. At first, he didn't know what was going on. He said, "What about?" I said, "I want to leave this place." I was sitting on the chair like this, and
He was behind me. He was holding a stick and hitting his palm with it. He kept walking behind me to force me to turn back and look at him. He said, "Okay, where do you want to go?" He was trying to make fun of me. I told him I used to live in Germany. If you don't want to send me back to Germany, I neither want to return to Iran nor stay in Iraq. Send me wherever you want. He said, "We'll send you to Ramadiya camp in Iraq." I'd heard about Ramadiya camp and that the conditions there weren't good. I said I didn't want to go there, but he said, "That's it. You're going to Ramadi. And if you put us under pressure, you'll end up in Iraqi prisons." I told my wife about it too. I'm not sure if she told him about it or not. But 2 days later, they came to me and said, "We want to transfer you." They took me into the streets of Karachi and told me, "There you go, this is Pakistan." I had no idea where to go. I didn't speak their language, I didn't have a passport or money, nothing. I didn't have anything. If the police officer had asked me what I was doing there, I wouldn't have had anything to prove who I was. In the streets of Karachi, I saw someone who looked Iranian. I told him I was looking for one of my friends. His name was Siavash Mirghafari. He gave me his address and offered to show me the way. I told him Siavash was a close friend of mine. He took me to Siavash's place. The day after that, they took me to the UN office. I received a UN card and $50 a month for my expenses. That saved me from starving on the streets. They gave me Nushin while she was very sick. She had a fever and was vomiting on the plane. She was coughing too. I realized they hadn't taken care of the kid well.
Daddy told me that mommy would return. I was around 4, and whenever I saw a beautiful woman, I asked my father to ask her if she would like to be my mother. I needed to have a mother.
Now it's been 25 years. My daughter was born in October 1987. We entered Iraq in February 1988, and when I returned after 2 years, she was still there. Razia has been there for around 25 years. I went to Ashraf about 10 to 15 times. I have to get her out. When she enters the free world, it'll be up to her if she wants to live with me or not. If she doesn't, I'll help her to have a good life. But it is my responsibility to get her out of there.
Because moving to Iraq was basically your decision.
That's right, because I'm responsible for that, and I will never forget it. I will continue this till the day I die. I hope my destiny serves as a lesson for those who want to team up with different political groups. I want them to know that the MKO is a real hypocrite, as they are referred to in Iran. They seem to be something, but in reality, they are something else. The Islamic Republic has figured them out very well.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily around the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of